32 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Moteur et action.
سلم عالديرة يا طير الطال الأرض الكريمة مخدوش اللي فينا سلم لي عريحة وسلم عالديرة يا طير الطال
Good afternoon, this is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai of Nana show. You just listened to a song that was released a few months ago, 3 months ago to be exact, by the fabulous Saint Levant and accompanied by MC Abdul, who's an amazing kid from Gaza who has recently gone on a tour. And that song was Dira. It was accompanied by what looks like a North African, perhaps a Moroccan band. Today's show, we have several things to share. To start out with, we're going to be talking about what's happening in South Lebanon right now, and Northern Israel, of course, as a consequence. And I've been following the Anti-Empire Project, and I recommend his sit-reps, meaning his little sessions that he has, usually that are about half an hour to an hour. He won't be doing it, as you'll notice at the end of this, his dispatch, basically. He won't be doing it for the next few weeks, but I would definitely follow him on YouTube. It's Anti-Empire Project, because he has these updates mainly on things that you're not hearing about, which is, for example, what's happening in terms of resisting occupation in South Lebanon, and in terms of other acts of resistance that we don't hear about. We only hear about the cataloging of miseries and the horror that's happening, which is important. So we'll start with that. That's about a half hour, close to half hour clip. And this one is about the Gaza war, of course, day 242. And it includes information about southern Lebanon and northern Israel, and how northern Israel had attacked southern Lebanon with white phosphorus, which is banned internationally. And white phosphorus, they took advantage of some dry days to set fires, basically, to hundreds and perhaps thousands of acres of land, olive trees and such, that they've set fire to on northern in southern Lebanon. And in retaliation, the Lebanese resistance also returned fire and set fire to one of the settlements, which had to be completely evacuated. And also there's been there's a report included in that dispatch on fighting in the West Bank and in northern, in southern Gaza city, and in Rafah. Also, again, fighting you'll only hear about in places like in on YouTube and Electronic Intifada and other places on their website too. He ends with talking about how there seems to be an escalation to war with Lebanon, which we've seen in the last few days, which would be really irrational for Israel to pursue. But there's been nothing about rational about this genocide. And so that's that. We're also, since we missed last show, I have a little clip that follows on Black Lives Matter and Palestine, and remembering George Floyd, and something about what Joe Biden is capable of, that was performed by a comedian, and a reading of the poem, Saul Williams' poem, Dear America. And we'll end the show with a song about Jerusalem called Al-Quds, which is a song by the great iconic singer, Lebanese singer, Fairuz. Enjoy.
All right, Gaza War Day 242, or 242. If you don't know the reference, that's okay, because it's pretty much defunct anyway. No end in sight. Interestingly, Biden's offer of a ceasefire, which he made, the speech that he made a couple days ago, which we talked about in our therapy session on Sunday, it hasn't left the news. It's been days, and the American officials are still talking about it. Like the Israelis, they're continuing to pretend the Israelis haven't rejected it, which they have. They're continuing to talk to Israelis. They're calling on the Israeli hostage families to accept the deal. The Biden spokesman the Count Chocula guy, he said that Hamas is the only obstacle to the deal. So they're trying to keep this going. They're trying to keep this item going. And it's not entirely clear to me why. The best I can make of it is this is an extremely expensive and credibility destroying operation to try to blame Hamas for something. Even though Hamas, they've called Hamas sexual predators. They've called Hamas beheaders of babies, both of things that Israelis are proven to be and that Hamas are not, but they've called them everything. They've demonized them comprehensively. They've said they have to be destroyed. They've celebrated the deaths of thousands of them. They've said that the rest of them have to be exterminated. They've done all this incredible demonization of Hamas across Western society. And now they're doing this to blame them for not taking a deal. And it's totally, of all the things they're accusing Hamas of doing, this seems to be among the least. I mean, sure, they've always blamed them for the genocide of Palestinians, but who are they convincing beyond people they already have convinced? It's hard to say. The G7, in one unified way, has said that Hamas has to take this deal. There's an interesting statement, actually, they made. It's on the State Department website or whatever, that all the leaders of the G7 countries have said Hamas has to take the deal. They said something like, this deal, comma, it's an interesting statement. It says, this deal, comma, which Israel has expressed willingness to take or something. Let me pull it up here before I go on. Okay. Let's take a look, focus on this last paragraph here. We call on Hamas to accept this deal, comma, that Israel is ready to move forward with, comma, and we urge countries with influence over Hamas to help ensure that it does so. Israel has already rejected this deal. Israel has already rejected this deal. The G7 are all extensive suppliers, funders, spiritual best friends with Israel. They know about this, but they're all saying this deal, comma, that Israel is ready to move forward with, comma, and we urge countries with influence over Hamas. I mean, it's so interesting that they want countries with influence over Hamas to do stuff that they're not willing to do when they have influence over Israel. But of course, what they do have the ability to do is lie through their teeth, which Biden also has, and they're doing that to the best of their, to the most brazen extent imaginable. The other note that I wanted to say, Biden mentioned in his lecture the other day that the deal that he was putting on the table included 600 trucks a day humanitarian aid. It's been a trickle of aid. People are starving. You've probably seen all the starvation happening, all the starvation of children that they're doing, which Israelis, of course, are celebrating. Israeli society loves to see starving children. So here's another thing that it says here. The deal outlined by President Biden that would lead to an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the release of all hostages, a significant and sustained increase in humanitarian assistance for distribution throughout Gaza. This is an admission that food is being used as a weapon. This is an admit. They're saying, take the deal and we'll get you more humanitarian assistance for distribution throughout Gaza. So their humanitarian assistance is contingent on Hamas taking this deal, which means they are holding the population hostage and using starvation to try to compel them to make make a deal. That's the G7. The whole G7 has signed on to that. The combined West, as the pro-Russia people like to call them. So, look, one question that arises is all of this just, did they do all of this just to blame Hamas? Or is it some kind of ineffective pressure where the idea is that Biden wants to pressure Israel, but America wants to make sure that any pressure on Israel is exerted in a way as to preserve Israel's ongoing genocide and its ability to conduct genocide indefinitely into the future. If you're trying to pressure someone that you love, and you're trying to do it in a way that would never hurt them, and you see them committing a crime, a murder in progress, and you want to make sure they can complete that murder, you're not going to exert any pressure that might challenge their ability to commit the murder, the mass murder. So America is not going to threaten them with anything like cutting weapon supplies or even, you know, maybe letting a Security Council resolution pass or letting the ICC warrants be fulfilled. Instead, the American Congress has passed a resolution to sanction the International Criminal Court, which is also not good for them long term. But nobody is thinking long term on the pro-Israel side anymore, which is a point I'm going to return to. So those are the only two options. This is either just one long, the only two options I can think of anyway, but this is either just one long-winded attempt at blaming Hamas for yet one more thing, or it's a incredibly gentle attempt to exert pressure based on a hypothesis that there are more Israelis who care about their own hostages than they do, than actually exists, and that more Israelis who want to stop the war than actually exist. There are not. That constituency is much smaller than I think the Biden people think, if that's what's going on. You probably have figured out by now, or I've said it explicitly, that I'm not a big believer in assigning incompetence to the enemy. I believe that if your enemy or your opposition looks incompetent, you should study very carefully what they're doing and try to figure out how it could be competent and how you could be deceiving yourself and believing what you want to believe about them. These moves, this whole rollout of this ceasefire proposal only to be spat on by Netanyahu publicly, they don't make it easy. They don't make it easy. The easiest explanation is that they are flailing and have no idea what they're doing, which again makes them very dangerous and makes this moment very dangerous, which I'm going to return to. Now, I want to tell you a bit about how Hamas has responded to this ceasefire pantomime. One of the leaders, Osama Hamdan, made a press conference today, and a lot of what he said focused on the Palestinian prisoners. And this is a really important point because you'll see Biden's ceasefire proposal are going around in the media as a ceasefire for hostages deal. So Israel gets its hostages back, Palestinians get a short ceasefire before Israel resumes the war. Great, shiny deal. That's what Israel wants. That's not what Hamas wants. That's not what the Palestinians have ever wanted. They want to trade the Israeli hostages / prisoners of war, many of them are military prisoners, for the Palestinian prisoners, the thousands, about 10,000 Palestinian prisoners who have been absolutely tortured at a more intense rate and level of torture since October 7th, and hundreds, maybe thousands of whom have been detained since October 7th. And this is such a huge contrast, the things that Palestinians are doing and suffering on a mass scale for their own prisoners, for the sake of getting their prisoners back, for the sake of ultimately making it a situation where Israel cannot take Palestinian prisoners, do not have that power to take Palestinian prisoners. That is the end goal of a free Palestine, of liberation, that if there are criminals that are Palestinian, they will be imprisoned by their own Palestinian state, not by a colonizing apartheid state that hates them racially and believes them to be racially inferior. That such a state should not have any, that has no business imprisoning and incarcerating the people they're colonizing. So it was interesting that this Hamas leader made such an emphasis on the prisoners in the press conference today. The other thing that, I mean, Hamas spokespeople have been talking to the media about this supposed Biden ceasefire. They, one of them said that they haven't even received a proposal. All they've received from the Israelis is an objection to the mediator proposal that has been made, the mediators being Qatar and Egypt. Another statement from Hamas that I've seen today, I'm going to quote from it. It says as follows: Netanyahu's statements somewhat respond to Biden's speech, indicating that he does not want to move toward any practical agreement. The primary guarantee for implementing any agreement is our strength on the ground as a people and resistance. That shows a real understanding of the situation by Hamas. We will not allow the occupation to have any role in arranging our internal affairs, whether the situation inside Gaza or managing the crossings in general, especially the Rafah crossing. The occupation must withdraw from the Rafah crossing, which is a Palestinian consensus, and the previous administration of the crossing should return. Arranging the Palestinian situation is an internal matter we Palestinians will manage without agreeing to any regional or international pressure. So Hamas is basically saying, you're not going to use negotiations to change the status quo out of our favor, to partially occupy more of Gaza than you've had before, to regime change the authorities in Gaza. All of those things are up to the Palestinians alone, and they're not gonna move from, they're announcing that they're not gonna move from that position. Might as well talk a bit more about Gaza. There are a field videos that I saw from Gaza today, two of them. They are from Jabalia. There's a major explosive ambush. There's a field report of fighting, targeting tanks and other armored vehicles. I can't tell whether these are field reports that I've already read and talked to you about in previous sit-reps, because we know that Israel's largely withdrawn from Jabalia. So these videos of the fighting in Jabalia probably are from before, and they're just rolling them out now. That's what I think is going on. There is actually fighting on the ground in southern Gaza City. I've seen field reports of bulldozers, Merkavas hit in southern Gaza City, and there's also been immense aerial bombing of the central Gaza, the camps, Burej camp, Nusayrat camp, and southern Gaza City. So the Israelis are fighting now in the north, I mean the south of the north, I guess you could say, the south of Gaza City as well as the middle of Gaza. So there's also massive fighting in Rafah, continuing fighting in Rafah in the very south. So active war in the north and the south and the center. All over Gaza, there's continuous fighting after the withdrawal from Jabalia and Zeitoun. Remember, 3 weeks ago, Israel lined everything up and said they were invading Rafah. They attacked Rafah with one division and sent two divisions north to Zeitoun and Jabalia, and they've withdrawn from both Zeitoun and Jabalia. They are, however, invading the West Bank. They're all over the West Bank. Tubas, Jenin invaded again. Nablus, there was major fighting in Nablus and the Balata refugee camp associated with Nablus. they assassinated, the Israelis assassinated a young resistance leader named Adam Faraj and another resistance fighter named Mu'taz al-Nabulsi during a wedding, staying on brand for the Israelis, attacking people at a wedding. There was also a more treachery by the Palestinian Authority in Tubas, helping the Israelis and the Al-Quds, Surah Al-Quds. They made another statement talking about how they really, really don't want to be fighting against their own people. So that's the West Bank. Now, I've referred continuously to the idea that Israel is making errors. When I quoted the latest speech from Nasrallah, he said their detachment from reality is causing them to make bigger and bigger errors. I think he was referring to what I'm about to talk to you about, which is I'm seeing a lot of indicators of a major escalation with Lebanon. There are statements that kind of fanatical Israeli politicians have been making forever about how they need to go and destroy Beirut, they need to destroy Lebanon, they need to push all the residents of Lebanon's borderlands all the way north, they need to occupy Lebanon, they need to destroy Beirut. That is kind of continuous for decades. I mean, since Israel's existed, they've talked about destroying all their neighbors. They love to talk about destroying their neighbors. And Lebanon, because Hezbollah has opened that front against them since October 8th, they have been talking about escalation. There, you remember Nasrallah has mocked them. He said, "With what forces are you going to invade Lebanon when your forces have been so battered fighting in Gaza?" And the thing is, once again, the strategic logic in terms of conservation of their military capacities would mitigate against attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon. They know that Hezbollah has better strategic depth. They're not surrounded the way that Gaza is. They have supply lines. They have more missiles. They have better missiles. They have the ability to hit any target in Israel. And they have been reciprocating everything that Israel has done. And that's why these have been the days of fire, forest fires, that have been set by Israel in the first case in Lebanon, and then right back at them in northern Israel. So I'm just showing a map here of, this is the settlement, the Israeli settlement of Kiryat Shemona. You may know these names, Kiryat Shemona, Metula, Chiam. These are all areas, Shlomi, these are all areas along the Israel-Lebanon border that Israel has used to create a posture, an intimidating posture by having surveillance equipment and military bases and armored vehicles and cannon and everything all along this border between Lebanon and Israel. And these are the things that have been continuously hit by missiles and rockets and artillery from Hezbollah for the past 8 months now. 9th month starting in a few days. And Kiryat Shemona, you can see green are relatively forested areas. It's not all, people get the idea that the Middle East is a desert. It's not all desert. The Mediterranean climate, there's lots of agriculture, and are up here in the higher elevation, there's plenty of forested area. And these days, the temperature is high. It's very dry. and it's very conducive to forest fires. And Israel has been trying to burn the Lebanese forest for the duration of this war and before. They've used incendiary ammunition. They've tried to set forest fires deliberately. They find the forest is covered. The settler supermen like to see everything and not be seen. So they like to be able to see. They don't like the concealment that forests provide. Colonizers hate forests. They hate trees. I've talked about this before. They destroy olive trees. They destroy Lebanese cedars. They hate trees. They want to be able to see. They don't like to be seen. They take the high grounds, the Golan Heights. They occupy these areas and they try to look down on the people they're colonizing. So they took advantage of the weather to light a bunch of the Lebanese forest on fire. And then Hezbollah reciprocated. So now Kiryat Shemona has been affected very badly by fires. They were under continuous rocket fire since the war started. Most of the residents had left, but now, as of now, I've seen reports that essentially the entire settlement has been emptied. So Safed, as you can see down here, another area surrounded by forest, another area that is burning right now. So we have, there's this type, colonial warfare is always a war on the means of survival. It's always a war on nature, but it really is quite stark now. Both things, that they're attacking the forest directly, the Israelis are, and now they're having their own forest, the forest they stole from the Palestinians, and those are burning now because Hezbollah is lighting them on fire as well. So now the entire north of Israel, Palestine, is on fire. If it's forested, it's on fire. And that is also a source of, I don't know, rage, colonial rage from the Israelis, which I think is also goading them into, I think, an extreme response and another invasion. I think there's been, as I said, amped up rhetoric from Israeli politicians. It's time for Lebanon to burn. It's time for Beirut to burn, all this kind of stuff. Now they're burning too. But I do see all of this when you put it all together, the statements by them, the speeches by Nasrallah, and the fact of these fires, the targeting of the Iron Dome, the way that the Hezbollah came so close to fire these shoulder-launched missiles on an Israeli base the other day. I think that an escalation of this war is coming, and I don't think it's going to be very long. So that, I think I'll leave it with that. I will say this, though. This is probably going to be my last sit rep for several weeks. I have to travel, not to Gaza. I'm not going to Gaza, but I do have to travel for work. I'm not going to have great internet. I'm not going to be able to post these. I might try to do some short form content, take a page out of Greg Stoper's book and post a minute or two a day if I get a chance from my cell phone. I think I'll be able to get some kind of data plan where I'm going, and I'll try to do that if I can. I mainly say this so you're not alarmed. Nothing happened to me. I just won't be reporting like I did for a couple of weeks, at the very least in this format. I will try to do something. I'll still be on Twitter probably, although again, probably not as much as I usually am. So hang in there. I told the tankies to make sure they get together in my absence. So hopefully you'll watch Sina's feed and Sina's channel, The East is a Podcast. Not here, it won't be here. And and like and subscribe and comment, and you guys hang in there while I'm gone. I definitely recommend the East is following the East is a podcast in the meantime for reports and thank yous, and of course the Electronic Intifada. There'll be probably 2, maybe 3 live streams before I'm back. So I will see you then. Maybe I'll see you in some short form way on Instagram or YouTube Shorts or something too. TikTok, maybe. We'll see. I'll do what I can. Take care. Hang in there. We'll see you soon.
There's one aspect of George Floyd's death that we aren't allowed to talk about. We could say that George Floyd deserved to be safe, that he should be alive today. We could say that he was murdered by police. We can maybe even allege that he wasn't murdered. But there is a third rail that we can't talk about, which makes me want to talk about it, which is this reported by Morningstar, which is Minnesota cops were actually trained by Israeli forces. Officers from the U.S. police force responsible for the killing of George Floyd received training in anti-terror tactics from Israeli law enforcement officers. At least 100 Minnesota police officers attended a 2012 conference hosted by the Israeli consulate in Chicago, the second time such an event had been held. There, they learned the violent techniques used by Israeli forces as they terrorized the occupied Palestinian territories under the guise of security operations. What the hell? Why would the American police, who are enforcing American laws, need training from the Israeli military? Also, why are we treating American citizens as enemies of the state? 3 years before the Ferguson protests, Tim Fitch, the chief of the very same St. Louis County Police Department responsible for firing tear gas at activists and concerned citizens, had flown to Israel to receive training from Israeli police, intelligence, and military in a week-long course on terrorism-focused policing. That training was organized by the Anti-Defamation League, which has conducted its national counterterrorism seminar in Israel since 2004. This is from an internal ADL memo. The ADL has been taking law enforcement officers to Israel for educational and training purposes since 2004. We have involved 500 to 600 law enforcement officers and partners. These trips have built bonds, created trust, and help deepen the ADL relationships with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and leaders. Now, why would a supposed civil rights group like the ADL want to cozy up with and support violent policing tactics? Well, maybe they aren't a civil rights group. Maybe they are something else with an entirely different un-American agenda. And over the past couple months, we've now seen how these cozy relationships can manifest. They can call on officers to step in because Americans are dangerous. Or not step in, depending on who the perpetrators are. I don't know, just putting this information out there.
People are upset with Joe Biden, I think because they either don't know or they forget the kinds of things Joe Biden's capable of, right? You might have heard of the 1994 crime bill. The United States, one of the most massive pieces of anti-crime legislation ever passed. Joe Biden was actually one of the people behind that. If you watch the video of Clinton signing it, Biden is one of the first people he hugs. But people forget that Joe Biden was also behind the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act. And in that legislation, there was something called the 100-to-1 rule. 100-to-1 rule meant if you were caught with any amount of crack cocaine, you would get the same mandatory minimum sentence as 100 times the amount in powder cocaine. Same drug, different forms. So if you got caught with 50 grams of crack, the size of a Snickers bar, you would get the same 10-year minimum prison sentence as someone carrying a 5-kilo briefcase of powder cocaine. White people, more likely to use powder cocaine. Black people, more likely to use crack cocaine. White people, the vast majority of cocaine users during the war on drugs. But of course, they were not the ones who were caught and arrested, and they were not the ones who filled up the prisons.
The president says he wants to wage a war on drugs, but if that's true, what we need is another D-Day, not another Vietnam.
The truth is, every major crime bill since 1976 that's come out of this Congress, every minor crime bill, has had the name of the Democratic senator from the state of Delaware, Joe Biden, on that bill.
The Biden anti-crime bills are the toughest in a decade to pass the Senate. They bring all federal agencies, from the FBI to the Defense Department, into a direct attack upon illicit drugs. Delaware's own Joe Biden.
You must take back the streets. And you take back the streets by more cops, more prisons. It doesn't matter whether or not they were deprived as a youth. It doesn't matter whether or not they had no background that enabled them to become socialized into the fabric of society. It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. So I don't want to ask, what made them do this? They must be taken off the street. They will, or a portion of them will, become the predators 15 years from now. And Madam President, we have predators on our streets. They are beyond the pale, many of those people. Beyond the pale. We have no choice but to take them out of society.
That is white power. When you can destroy generations of a community with the stroke of a pen. Joe Biden was one of the most senior Democrats to push the Iraq War. 1 million dead. This is who we're dealing with.
So let's everybody make sure we understand one thing. If there is not a way to secure those weapons of mass destruction, this is an exercise in futility. If we can make the case that the threat is real and dire, that a free and democratic Iraq, if it could be accomplished, could have a cleansing impact on that part of the world and make our life easier significantly down the road if we do things right, that it is worth the price, opening the gate in a way to the part of the world that needs to, at some point on their own, come into the 21st century.
Kind of went quiet in the early 2000s, took a backseat during the Obama years, and then he completely lost it, like really, really lost it, right? My favorite Joe Biden clip is where he turns up to some press conference in Idaho, and he's looking for the local congresswoman, and he's going, Jackie, where's Jackie? Is Jackie here? Jackie? Where's Jackie? Jackie died, bro. Jackie died. She had been dead for a month. He had to apologize to the family. Completely lost his mind. You seen those heartwarming TikToks where there's like an old man with Alzheimer's and he's lost his memory and he doesn't know where he is. He doesn't recognize his own family. And then suddenly someone plays his favorite song and he comes back to life. That's what genocide has done for Joe Biden. Right? He was lost, he didn't know who he was, had the chance to green light a second Nakba, and Joe is back. The Wonder Years are back, baby. A lot of people want the Democrats to lose, understandably. A lot of people want the Democrats to be punished and to suffer a historic and humiliating defeat. And white liberals are very tense, right? They're like, is that what you really want? Is that what you really want? You want Trump to come back? You want Trump to win? What I want is for you to not lecture us on how to respond to a genocide you didn't try to stop, okay? You think that's a good idea? You think that's a good idea for your community? Because it's your community that's going to suffer if Trump comes back. People like you are going to suffer. What do you think of that? I think that a political system that ultimately makes you choose between genocidal dementia and cheeseburger-powered fake tan Hitler is a system worth overthrowing, okay? Maybe that is the conclusion you should be coming to instead of lecturing black and brown people on why they don't worship the Democrats, okay?
Dear America, we don't want it. We did not ask for it. We have no need for it. We are not interested in the myths you teach your children. We know how the West was won. We know what forefathers felt. We seek greater freedoms. Your imperial claims do not interest us. We run on alternative fuels. We joined your army for health care and benefits. Your enemies are not ours. Your weapons have been formed against us. Your borders know no boundaries. We know where you keep the keys. We know how the wealth was built. We know why the wars were fought. We know who you chose to kill. We people your prisons. We know the voices you fought to suppress for lesser freedoms, for cheaper prices, for unshared profits. We know your stock tips. We know what we bring to the table and how lonely you'll be if we don't bring it. We know every lie you've told and every lie told to you to save your precious ears, to save you from your fears. We have begun our healing journey. Our fossil fuels have fueled enough. Diamonds, cobalt, uranium, gold, oil. The mass graves of our ancestors have enriched the soil. And then you arrive with bulldozers and tanks, steal from their graves to store in your banks. We know, end of cycle. The war you wage is against yourself. Our liberation is inevitable, and we claim this year to make it known. We know what the schools won't teach. We know where the preacher sleeps. We know how the reaper reaps his stash of hella cells. We know all your private hells. You can't unring the bell.
وتمسح الحزن عن المساجد. السماء عيوننا إليك ترحل كل يوم وإنني أصلي. الطفل في المغارة وأمه مريم وجهان يبكيان.
الطفل في المغارة وأمه مريم وجهان يبكيان
لأجل من تشردوا السلام وسقط العدل على المداخل.
سقط العدل.
حين هوت مدينة القدس تراجع الحب وفي قلوب الدنيا استوطنت الحرب. حين هوت مدينة القدس تراجع الحب وفي قلوب الدنيا استوطنت الحرب. الطفل في المغارة
وأمه مريم وجهان يبكيان
وإنني أصلي.
Very often, Juneteenth is presented as a story of news of the Emancipation Proclamation traveling slowly to the Deep South in Texas, but it was really a story of power traveling slowly and of freedom being seized. On Wednesday, June 19th, WPFW presents Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance from 5 a.m. until midnight. Through discussions, music, and spoken word, we will interrogate the history of that day, the true meaning of freedom, and the role resistance continues to play in securing liberation. That's Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, Wednesday, June 19th, 5 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
The D.C. Black Fathers Matter Project, 5th Annual Father's Day Motorcade, Saturday, June 15th. The motorcade honoring black fathers will depart at 12 noon from the African American Civil War Museum at 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. Arrival is as early as 10:30 a.m. to participate. The motorcade will end at the Big Chair on Martin Luther King Avenue and V Street Southeast at approximately 1 p.m. DC residents are encouraged to display banners or posters in your neighborhood, community, or church, beginning Friday, June 14th, in honor of Black Fathers. More info at 202-240-1182. That's 202-240-1182 or dcblackhistory.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, June 12th. Here are some headlines. The Southern Baptist Convention today narrowly rejected a constitutional amendment barring women from all pastoral positions. The amendment would have added language to the SBC Constitution saying that only men could be affirmed or employed, quote, as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by Scripture, close quote. The vote did receive support from 61% of the delegates, but failed to get the required two-thirds supermajority. The action reversed a preliminary vote last year in favor of the official ban. If the measure passed, more churches were expected to voluntarily leave the Nashville-based denomination. In other news, Virginia's chapter of the NAACP filed a federal lawsuit yesterday against the Shenandoah County School Board after the school district restored the names of Confederate generals at two public schools. The school board voted last month to reverse a decision made in 2020 to change the names of schools linked to Confederate leaders Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Turner Ashby. The lawsuit states that students will be, quote, required against their will to endorse the violent defense of slavery pursued by the Confederacy and the symbolism that these images have in the modern white supremacist movement, close quote. The lawsuit argues that the board violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Education Opportunities Act, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and the 14th Amendment, which prohibits racial discrimination in government-supported institutions. In more state news, a federal court has blocked Florida from enforcing a law that bans gender-affirming care for transgender youth and restricts care for trans adults. Judge Robert Hinkle ruled yesterday that the 2023 law is unconstitutional and violates the equal protection rights of transgender people. In his ruling, Judge Hinkle said that gender identity is real, and that there is a widely accepted standard of care, which includes puberty blockers and hormone treatment. The law banning care was championed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and made Florida among the most restrictive states for transgender care in the nation. Governor DeSantis has vowed to appeal the ruling. And in international news, a U.S.-backed Israeli proposal for a ceasefire and hostage deal appears to be in limbo, with neither side yet publicly committing to the plan as talks continue. Earlier this week, the United Nations voted to back the resolution, which would unfold in three phases, beginning with a six-week ceasefire, the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian detainees, and negotiations to reach a permanent ceasefire, followed by Israel's military withdrawal from Gaza, and concluding with a reconstruction process lasting from 3 to 5 years. And in weather today, in New York City, it is 77 under mostly cloudy skies. In Washington, D.C., 81 degrees under mostly cloudy skies, with temperatures